231. That's the average number of apps used by many companies. This leads to a lot of context switching that can distract employees and costs your company. Luckily, Grammarly can help. Grammarly's AI works in over 500,000 apps and websites, making it easy for your team to crank out clear, on-brand emails, documents, messages, and more. In just one click, they can go from blank page to first draft, all without leaving the page they're on. Grammarly has 15 years of experience building effective, secure AI that can be implemented in days with minimal IT overhead. It goes beyond basic grammar to help tailor writing to specific audiences, whether that means adding an executive summary, fine-tuning tone, or cutting out jargon. Join 70,000 teams who save an average of $5,000 per employee per year using Grammarly. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise-ready AI.
Need parts now? O'ReillyAuto.com offers in-store pickup, same-day home delivery, or next-day home shipping. Get more parts your way at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
If you're a maintenance supervisor for a commercial property, you've had to deal with everything from leaky faucets to flickering light bulbs. But nothing's worse than that ancient boiler that's lived in the building since the day it was built. 50 years ago. It's enough to make anyone lose their cool. That's where Grainger comes in. With industrial-grade products and dependable fast delivery, Grainger can help with any challenge, from worn-out components to everyday necessities. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Tuesday, December 3rd, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the first two episodes of Star Wars Skeleton Crew, and then we'll present interviews with the creators and stars of the show. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editors Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
BJ Colangelo.
Hi, hi, hi,
And Star Wars expert Brian Young.
Hello.
Brian, thank you so much for joining us. It's always great to talk to you about a new Star Wars project as it debuts. And these first two episodes are up on Disney Plus right now. Anybody can watch them if you have a subscription. So I guess I want to just open things up to everybody and just let's kick things off with some general thoughts. Maybe we won't get into spoilers quite yet, just in case people maybe haven't watched the show and are looking to us to figure out whether or not it's worth their time. Brian, since you're our guest, I'll start with you. What do you think about the first two episodes of Skeleton Crew?
You know, if there's an exact adorable opposite to Andor, this show is it. It's just a lot of fun and it's adorable. I think adorable is sort of adorable adventures. I think probably the best way I can describe it. A lot of people are going to throw around the Spielberg Amblin Entertainment 80s vibe of it. And I think that is very obviously what the filmmakers were wearing on its sleeve, on their sleeves. So if you're into that sort of vibe and you're into Star Wars, I can't see a reason why you'd not enjoy this.
Brad, what do you make of this show?
Yeah, I am super into it so far. I think that the first episode, it drags a little bit, and it's mostly because they're doing so much like world building and character establishing and that kind of thing. And it's supposed to kind of be this, you know, mundane place before we set off into the adventure that the series follows. But once that adventure gets going, it starts to pick up the pace, the energy gets there. The kids are really, for me, what makes it work so well, because each one of the four kids is absolutely fantastic and wonderful. And just they obviously have, you know, attitude and heart, and they're a fun dynamic. And so just seeing them, you know, jet set off into the Star Wars universe feels like a lot of fun. And I'm definitely enjoying it so far, and I'm very curious to see where it goes.
So, BJ, what did you think about these first two episodes?
Do we have a moment to talk about our new Lord and Savior, Neil? Because that's where I'm at with the show. No, the show is so sweet, and it's I love kids getting into hijinks. That's one of my favorite sort of tropes to deal with. And I think seeing that within the Star Wars universe is fantastic, because how many of us watched Star Wars as kids and then played Star Wars as kids, and now we're just watching kids in Star Wars. I just think that that's really, really cool. I mean, kids in Star Wars that are not about to be, like, killed. So I guess specify that. But yeah, it's just really fun. I'm with Brad that the kids are really what make it for me. There's so much cool stuff going on. Lots of interesting lore, of course, but it really is these kids for me, and it really did reignite that joy that I had seeing Star Wars for the first time when I was about their age.
Nice. Okay. So I feel like a few different times now I've come on here and been like, hey, the first couple episodes of this new Star Wars show really intrigued me. And then the show would just kind of eventually collapse. So I'm a little hesitant to do that again, having not seen the remaining episodes in this season. But that's genuinely how I feel about it. I'm intrigued by the fact that as of these first two episodes, there does not appear to be any direct connections to other Star Wars stories. And I think there's definitely potential here to lure in a younger audience and provide this sort of like baptism in the waters of Star Wars fandom that Lucasfilm seems to be wanting to do with the show. So I think it's a success so far. And I'm just kind of hoping that it doesn't curl inward on itself and like get caught up in like ties to other projects and stuff like that, at least to a level that that like some of these other Star Wars shows that have largely been deemed failures have sort of fallen prey to. So, Brian, I wanted to ask you, as somebody who pays super close attention to all things Star Wars, was there anything beyond the surface level here that jumped out at you in terms of the lore, like BJ was alluding to earlier, or any of these connections? I mean, like I was talking about, narratively, I didn't feel any links to other Star Wars projects, but I'm sure there are nods and references and homages and things of that sort. So were there any, explicit ones that you wanted to call out here?
Yeah, no, there were some that were just sort of fun nods, like the Hollow Circus from the Star Wars Holiday Special that Neil's siblings, especially little Tulo, are watching, that had me bursting out in laughter. But there were some that were narratively that even started that first episode that really forced me to appreciate the filmmaking more. You know, it started out with this really intricate riff on A New Hope, where we had our opening sort of text and the pan down, and the cargo cruiser sort of looks very much like the Alderaanian cruiser that Princess Leia is arriving in. And, you know, we sort of almost expect the Star Destroyer to come next, but we're taken by surprise. You know, where we have that instinct to think the ship is going to come overhead, the pirates sort of inject their tubes from the other side of the screen, and we're sort of taken by surprise. And where George Lucas was very clear in the color story of A New Hope, where we had the blues of the rebels and the black and white of the Imperials, you know, as they're gearing up for battle, we've got all the cargo crew in earth tones and the pirates in earth tones gearing up for battle in shot for shot, very much the same way as they're getting ready to fight. And, you know, the Empire's all in helmets and whatnot, but the pirates are all very much aliens. The only person that's in a helmet is the Captain Silvio. And he exchanges dialogue with the captain of the crew freighter that mirrors the dialogue between Vader and Captain Antilles. You know, like if this is a consular ship, where is the ambassador? Very much like, if there's no cargo, then why is this magnetically sealed? And we're sort of primed for this idea because of A New Hope, sort of, even if it's subconscious in the back of our mind, that when Vader meets this failure, he's able to redirect. He has the command of the people underneath him to say, you know, we're going to move in a different direction. We're going to tell everyone was dead. We're going to go find these plans. We're going to move this way. But when Silvio does this and they find that there's only a single credit here, they mutiny on him. And instantly, through the filmmaking, through what we expect from Star Wars, through these shots and callbacks, through what we'd expect, They turn it all on its ear and show us like, this is a totally different part of the galaxy. You can't expect that, that black and white, good and evil sort of thing. And I think it, it says a lot about the characters that we get introduced to and the difference in where we are in the galaxy. And I thought that was a particularly great deep cut. And the other one I really enjoyed was just all the American Graffiti stuff. Especially that call out to Bonch Falfa, with the kid who looks like he could be a young Ben Solo. As we know, Bob Falfa is Harrison Ford's character in American Graffiti, and he's constantly challenging John Milner to a race. So Bonch Falfa showing up to challenge Fern to a race is hilarious. And I would love to see that storyline pay off later, you know, if Fern learns her lesson and comes back to AT-AT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she could have a Marty McFly in Back to the Future Part 3 moment where he doesn't actually get hit by. That's great. I love those connections.
You know, there's a lot of little ones too, but those were the big ones. And that introduction from A New Hope, really turning everything on its ear, really prepared me for getting something different. I think in the same kind of way George Lucas did the Pan Up instead of the Pan Down in Attack of the Clones, where it was just like, hey, don't expect what you think you should right from the get-go.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, BJ, I wanted to ask you, like, latchkey kids are such an 80s idea to me, and I don't have any hard data in front of me to back this up, but I strongly suspect that the number of latchkey kids has gone down significantly in recent decades, and it kind of seems like I don't know. I was you used to be a teacher. You're like much more attuned to the youth of the world than I am, I think. So I was just wondering if that rang true to you as a thing that maybe young people might be open to relating to, or if that is another example of just culturally Hollywood being kind of stuck a little bit and like, yes, we're recapturing this Amblin thing from the 80s, but we've been doing that for 20 years at least now. And so, like, when are we going to move on and find a different aesthetic? So I was just wondering how all of that sat with you when you're watching this.
Sure. So you're totally right. The number of people that would consider themselves to be like latchkey kids dramatically drops off after, I would say, like the younger half of millennials. That's where we start to see like the stark decline. So there are definitely still latchkey kids. I mean, because, you know, poor people will always exist. So we will always have latchkey kids, but it's not nearly to the levels that it once was. But because so much of the media that we make is filtered through people who were kids in the 70s and 80s who were latchkey kids, that it then becomes this sort of fantasy world for a lot of them where they aspire to have the freedom of latchkey kids because, you know, you have these kids that are watching things, you know, like Stranger Things, and they're like, oh my God, I could never imagine being able to just leave my house on my bike and like my parent can't contact me with a cell phone. Like I can just go. That world doesn't exist, so it becomes almost aspirational. It's this fantasy world of like, God, wouldn't it be so cool to be able to do this? Because so many of them, you know, they're constantly being monitored because of technology or helicopter parents or whatever. And so I think that it's a combination of one, yes, we have been absolutely mining the 80s nostalgia well for far too long, and we need to move forward. But unfortunately, like everybody that makes decisions in Hollywood is not retiring. And like, so there's no upward mobility for anybody. And that is affecting the kinds of stories that we tell. But at the same time, I don't see it as a hindrance for new audiences because they will want to be like these characters. They may relate to them on a, you know, character level as terms of personality. But as far as the things that the kids get into in this, this is something that a lot of kids today are craving. Like, it's the reason why if you go on TikTok, so many high schoolers are obsessed with footage of people who went to high school in the early 2000s. Like they are like, can you imagine like not a cell phone in sight? Like how cool would that be? So I think kids watching this will be like, oh wow, that's really cool. So unfortunately the cycle is not going to break because it's going to continue to pay off.
Yeah.
Well, can I say too, like there's a really interesting story reason too, when you add up all of the unusual things about Ad-Adin, that's another one of those things that makes it feel like it's in this idyllic past as part of the Old Republic, right? As you look at why it seems like it doesn't belong as part of the rest of the galaxy and the kids don't fit in, that's part of it.
Yeah, definitely. And this is like the most Earth-like that Star Wars has ever been to me. You know, you've got like suburbia and like bus rides and stuff like that. So Brad, I was going to ask you, how did that mystery sit with you in terms of like, once the kids essentially steal the spacecraft and then get lost in hyperspace and they arrive at this spaceport in the beginning of episode two, nobody seems to believe that they're from Ad-Adin. And then they discover that their homeworld is this lost planet of eternal treasure. So what did you think about that, the way that that mystery has been seeded so far in these first two episodes?
Yeah, I like that story thread. I think it's interesting that in a movie that is like styled after the Goonies and has pirates who are seeking treasure, that the treasure itself is this mystery planet that everyone seems to think is a myth, and these kids are actually from that planet. When it comes to the aesthetic design of the planet itself, I'm a little bit annoyed that it looks too much like the suburbs of Southern California, when I think that they could have done a little more effort to make it a little more Star Wars-y. I understand like what they're going for, and obviously it's very intentional, but it almost feels a little too Earth-like in my estimation. And there's just too many similarities to like the neighborhoods that we've seen in, you know, ET and stuff like that. And I mean, there are shots that feel like they could have just bit like applied, you know, a sci-fi filter to a shot from ET, you know?
Yeah.
But you know, I still like the setup of like, you know, having them be latchkey kids and being able to go on this adventure. And I think it serves as a nice contrast to the places that they end up to, because that first pirate spaceport they visit is so cool. All of the aliens that they meet look incredible, you know, and obviously there's great practical effects at work here too. So, you know, it does what needs to be accomplished, but that's my little nitpick, I guess. Mm-hmm.
It made me laugh because like you think about Star Wars planets all being a single biome and this is like the suburb planet, but I think it also adds to that idea where like BJ was saying, like kids see themselves going like, man, I wish it could be like that. And what easier way to get kids on board with going, man, I wish my life was like that, than showing them neighborhoods that look like theirs.
Yeah.
In the suburbs. And then these kids also having to compete with going, I'm going into the Star Wars universe too. And they haven't seen anything like that either, because their planet isn't like that, because their planet looks like the suburbs from ET as well, which might actually have looked like what Yoda might have expected anyway, because, you know, ET knew what Yoda was like, and there's that whole closed loop there as well.
Yeah. Brian, without spoiling things for listeners, do you have any idea what this planet might be? Have there been references to this place in other Star Wars projects?
No. There really hasn't been. And I think to get into a really in-depth conversation about it, I mean, like, there's a lot of clues about what might be different about it. I think one of the big tip-offs, and again, one of the deep cuts that was really interesting, is the Republic Dactaries that Wim tries spending around, that his dad just hands him a handful for lunch money. This is the same kind of money that Qui-Gon tries to spend in order to pay for the hyperdrive on Tatooine in Phantom Menace. And they're even so sort of old and worthless in the Outer Rim then, you know, 40, 50 years before this takes place. Mm-hmm. And so it's already sort of an old, outdated bit of money there. So that would be the equivalent of, you know, Brad going to lunch and trying to pay with like a Spanish doubloon and somebody just going like, what? Why? And someone actually like recognizing it at some point and going like, no, this is not enough.
Yeah.
I don't know why you're at lunch trying to pay with Spanish doubloons, Brad, but it sounds
because
funny.
It's the currency that I have.
Yeah. So there's this interesting mystery there about why they're doing that, but there's also, you think about the myth of the Jedi, right? And even Rey, after this, is talking about how even Luke Skywalker is a myth to her, and the Empire has eradicated mentions of the Jedi. People don't know about the Force. Luke in the Outer Rim doesn't know what the Force is, and that can be as much as Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru suppressing that from him, but also nobody really knowing about it or talking about it. You know, Palpatine had done a really good job during the Clone Wars to eliminate that knowledge from the galaxy. In a generation, the Jedi not only became villains, but they became completely erased from history. And you have a kid who has a storybook here, who wants to be a Jedi, who wants to help people, who knows how Jedi temples work, and is really interested in this adventure in ways that none of the other kids of the galaxy are until, you know, you get to the sequels and you see the little kids in The Last Jedi with Temuri Blag and his friends on Canto Bight spreading these stories because of the spark that Luke Skywalker started. But this kid just has this storybook and it's a normal thing, and him and Neil are fighting with lightsabers and stuff. So it's like there really is something different about this place that feels like it is trapped out of time, and we don't know why that is. And it does feel unusual, and it does feel like there's something odd about it. And then there's that moment where the kids are just like, what are those? Are those planets? No, I think they're stars. Right. So we know there's something off about it, and it hasn't been mentioned anywhere else. And it's probably because, you know, maybe some weird Jedi erased it from the records, just like Kamino, or, you know, I mean, obviously the real world answer is they made it up for this show, but part of it is that I think they were going for some of that Treasure Island aesthetic where it's just like, we're going to have, you know, a place no one knows how to find. And, you know, when you look at the idea of a story in a high-tech universe where it's like, these kids are going to get lost from their planet. How do you do that in a world with Star Wars, where it's just like, well, we'll just backtrack where we were. Well, if it's a planet that's purposely hidden, if it's a planet that no one's heard of, if it's a planet that's no one's charted, what is the story behind that? Why is that? We're going to get some interesting mythology behind that. And I think that's part of the story that's going to be unfolding as we watch the rest of the series.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I feel like that was a really long answer.
No. All good. BJ, I wanted to ask you about the action, especially in that second episode. There's SM-33, which, by the way, I did not realize. I saw somebody point this out online, that SM-33 is Smee. Like the
Hook
character or whatever, a Peter Pan character. I was like, oh, that's pretty clever. You got me with that one. What did you think about that action sequence where SM-33 basically like kicks a bunch of ass on that planet, and he's got like his metallic peg leg and everything going on too, and this limp and everything. So I was just curious if that worked on like a visceral level for you, because some of the action in some of these Star Wars shows has been a little wonky, but I remember us praising the first or the action in the first couple episodes of what was the name of the previous show that just got canceled?
The Acolyte.
Yes, thank you. The Acolyte. So what do you think about the way that the show uses action so far in these first two episodes?
I mean, we're going to be comparing it to Amblin all day, but like it really does feel like that sort of adventure where the stakes feel just high enough where I am very concerned about these characters, but it also feels very purposeful. Like it's very showy in what this action is. It's the kind of action that you watch as a kid and go, whoa. And like, I think that that's why we have, you know, Smee, who, yes, is like this Hook kind of namesake character kicking a bunch of ass. And it feels like, oh, it's like Sloth. Like it's Sloth fighting the Fratellis. Like, this is awesome. I love this. And I just think that it's executed really, really well. I don't think that it is it's worried so much about like looking so cool that it bogs down the story. Like it just, it fits where it needs to. And it feels like the kind of exciting action that would be very scary for you if you're very young, but also like think is very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we're running out of time pretty quickly here. Brad, were there any other observations about the show that you wanted to make or call out or anything before we take a break and go to BJ's interviews?
No, I think for the most part, one of the things that I wanted to shout out was just the fantastic use of makeup and prosthetics and creature effects to create such a wide, you know, assembly of different pirates and aliens. Some are familiar, some are totally brand new. I really like that pirate captain Brutus. He's particularly cool, just like a badass wolf. I think SM33 is a great droid character, and Nick Frost's voice as that character is perfect. I just right now I think I'm most aside from the kids, I'm just caught up in like how cool the worlds are that we get to go to, and some of that is also with regards to episode 3, which isn't out yet but was provided to press, so we have seen that one, and there are some other cool new characters and locations introduced there as well. So yeah, I'm just right now, I think that this is a very cool way to start the series. And I hope it's something that kids can connect to, and maybe even kids who don't necessarily have like a connection to like the deep mythology of Star Wars, because like, I feel like this is something that I really would have loved when I was a kid, even without having any familiarity with Star Wars. So I hope it's something that can bring new audiences into Star Wars. And I hope that this is something that like Lucasfilm realizes that they can do every now and then, you know, like I don't know where this is going as far as if it will end up having, you know, any ties to established storylines or anything like that. But like, I like the idea that this is something removed from everything else we've seen in Star Wars, exists in the universe, feels refreshing and familiar at the same time. And I hope that there's room for stuff like this in the future as time goes on.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. BJ, any closing thoughts?
I just can't wait to see where this goes. Something that folks will hear when they hear the interviews is when I talked to the show co-creators, they dropped that there will be a twist at some point towards the end of the series. They obviously would not tell me what that is, but now that's all I can think about is like, well, what does that mean? What is going to be twisted? I need to know.
Interesting. Okay. The one little homage thing that I wanted to mention is I thought it was well done, pretty well done for a Disney show to have that Pirates of the Caribbean homage where the kids are trapped in the brig and trying to get the key out, very much like the Pirates ride. And then that was adapted into a scene in Pirates of the Caribbean movie franchise. But I didn't think it really like ground the show to a halt and like nudged us in the ribs and said, hey, look at this. Aren't you, you know, really proud of us for shoving in a reference in there? It felt like it was an organic part of the story, and it was just like a fun way for them to throw something in there as opposed to like bending over backwards to work it in, which sometimes some of these references can kind of feel that way to me. So,
let's talk about real quickly how cool Jude Law is. And first of all, how interesting his character is, because there's a little bit of mystery surrounding him as well, because we see him use the Force and there's the assumption that he's a Jedi, but very interesting character there.
Yeah. I mean, we've only seen him in the second episode. Like he barely shows up, but he's very like, Aragorn coded or something almost, you know? So that was intriguing. And Brian, I suspect at this point there's like a whole list of Force users who are not Jedi or Sith. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people who are Force sensitive who can manipulate it in some small ways, or who might not. Or again, you know, there's a lot of ways that people could make it appear as though they're using the Force as well.
Mm.
And so, you know, we saw that with Haja Estri in Obi-Wan Kenobi, where that was his whole shtick, was making people think he could use the Force. So who knows, you know?
Gotcha. Okay. Well, Brian, I want to give you the last word here. Was there anything else that you wanted to call out about the show or highlight or anything like that?
Yeah, there was a moment in the show where I don't know if I don't I can imagine where Brad stands on it, but I don't know if you all have any fondness whatsoever for the Ewok adventures. But I was about five or six when they came out, and they felt really magical to me. They're pretty objectively not great, but they had a feeling at 5 or 6 that they were pretty amazing, because they had this feeling like they were kids going on Star Wars adventures, right? And they grounded kids in those adventures and put them on that path. And there was this feeling I don't quite remember recapturing when I rewatched them, or rewatched them because I still do, that made me feel like I could be in the Star Wars universe watching it as that little kid. And there was a moment watching episode 2 where, if you remember, that character from the second Ewok adventure, the Battle for Endor, Teek, who was Noah, Wilford Brimley's character's sort of little speedster sidekick, shows up, and he's the wee ferryman who's going to take them to Port Borgo. And it sort of hit me with all that nostalgia and made me feel exactly like that little kid stepping into Star Wars again, and brought all of that magic back. And my hope is that they produce that same feeling I had as a little kid watching those Ewok movies as, you know, for kids today. But they're doing it so much better. They're improving on all of, I mean, kids' entertainment and stories designed for kids have advanced leaps and bounds better than they had, you know, in the last 40 years. And I hope that we can carry on in this trajectory and do a lot more Star Wars that is aimed toward this family audience that brings kids in this way, because this show is just so fun, and it's so breathless in its adventure and its earnestness, and I just really like it. That's not to, it doesn't take anything away from the grittiness and the politics that I love of Andor, and I think that's what's great about Star Wars, is that Skeleton Crew and Andor can coexist, and I can love them both.
Yeah, well said. Okay, well, let's take a break, and then we'll come back and present BJ's interviews with the cast and creators.
If you're a maintenance supervisor for a commercial property, you've had to deal with everything from leaky faucets to flickering light bulbs. But nothing's worse than that ancient boiler that's lived in the building since the day it was built, 50 years ago. It's enough to make anyone lose their cool. That's where Grainger comes in. With industrial-grade products and dependable fast delivery, Grainger can help with any challenge, from worn-out components to everyday necessities. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
An O'Reilly Auto Parts gift card is the perfect gift for that hard-to-buy-for person. Give the gift of convenience from O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
All right, so first up, BJ spoke with Ravi Cabot-Conyers, Kiriana Cratter, Robert Timothy Smith, and Ryan Kiera Armstrong. This is the quartet of kid actors here. BJ, anything you want to say to set this one up?
All I want to say is there is a very, very cute moment where I am interrupted so that one of the actors can tell me how much she likes my hair. Because when I walked into the room, for those listeners who don't know what I look like, I have half a shaved head and the other side is like big green curls. And not a lot of journalists look like I do. So I think they were used to like a lot of like very professional looking people, and then I walked in and they lost their minds and kept like screaming like, "You have hair like Beetlejuice but pretty, oh my god." And so then we like, I'm getting rushed by the PR people like, "Come on, I gotta get these kids out of here, I have to feed them." And so I'm trying to get this interview, and then at one point she very politely raised her hand, and that's what I'm doing when I say, "Yes, what did you want to say?" And then she goes, "I just have to, you know, talk about your hair or whatever." That is why that moment exists. Also, I will die for these children. If anyone bullies them, I will show up at your house.
Okay. With that threatening warning, here is PJ's conversation.
How are you all today?
Great. How are you?
Good. Okay. So, $1 million question. All of us are going to leave. We're going to go in the woods and we're going to find a mysterious
thing. I thought you said, like, literally.
Oh, yeah. We're all going to.
Really, gosh.
We're going to find something in the woods. Maybe it's a starship. Maybe not. But there is a green light and a button. Are you touching it or are you leaving it alone?
Oh, yeah.
Touching it?
Of course I am.
I'm touching it.
Touching it?
Yeah. I have to go touch it.
Might have to?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So we're all on the same page.
What especially motivates me is Ryan telling me not to, because that makes me want to touch it even more.
Yeah, like, it's the worst.
Yeah.
I feel like every time someone's like, don't, do not touch that. I'm like, now I want to touch
it. Because I want to know why. Why can't I touch the button?
Yeah, exactly. What will happen?
What do you know that I can't?
Exactly. What do you know what I don't? Yes.
Can I just say I love your hair so much? It's like KB.
Yeah, I know.
But it's like, you have your own pizzazz to it, and it looks so good. I love it.
Thank you. Okay, I did have the same thought when I was watching. I was like, yes, someone with half a shaved head. I love this. So thank you for the compliment.
Yeah.
So I have another question for you. Obviously, there are so many people who love Star Wars. Who was the most excited person in your life when you booked this job?
My dad.
Your dad? Yeah, tell me about it.
He was very just like, he was just like, because his favorite movie is A New Hope.
Okay.
And he was just like all over it. Like you know how big this is going to be? Like, this is going to be great. And it's just like, he's just so excited about it. And I was very excited about it too.
Amazing.
Yeah, I feel like my dad and mom were both equally excited, but for different reasons. My dad was excited because it was Star Wars, and he's been so into Star Wars his whole life, and it's been a huge part of my life, too. And then my mom was excited because she was looking at it from an actor's perspective, how fun it would be to explore this new universe, and it's something I'd never really done before. So together, mashed together, it gave me a great ton of experience and all I needed to be ready for Skeleton Crew.
Amazing. How about you two? And it could be you. You could be the person who's most excited.
Honestly, I think my dad and I shared it both. Like, I think it was, like, an equally, like, mutual, like, excitement. Like, I know, like, my first fitting, we were both, like, just kind of in awe of, like, seeing all the inspiration stuff. Oh, I know when we went to, like, the art department the first time, they have our sets, like, already built but in miniature form. Mm-hmm. And we were just looking at that, and it was so cool. Like, I was, like, starstruck.
Yeah, starstruck by your own thing you guys
like,
do.
Star Wars is fun.
Yeah. But that's real. Like, that's real. I think, like, I interview a lot of people, and, you know, we'll get to, like, you know, adults who've been like, I've been acting for 40 years, and I'll be like, well, do you still get excited about it? And they're like, you know, it's a day at work. And I'm like,
no.
It's okay to be excited about it. It's a cool thing that you're doing.
Yeah. No, it's, like, the opposite, I think, for us. Like, going to set every single day, I think it was like a new adventure. And
what new planet are we going to be on today?
There's always something new. But
yeah.
Oh, my dad introduced me as well. But I think like my entire family, and I was super excited. Like I was crying. And every day was like fangirling over everything and seeing things that I've seen in movies and also new things was also really, really cool. And it's really nice now that like my dad can like, when we first figured it out, he was like squealing for me. He was really proud of me, and it was really nice.
Good. You should all be so proud of yourselves, because the thing is, the show is really good, you guys.
Thank
like
you.
It's really fun, and you are all so interesting to follow. Like, you're such a great crew. So another question that I have for you is that Star Wars is also a very heavily merchandised sort of world. There are going to be, like, action figures of you and toys of you. Has that, like, processed in your brain, or is that still just, like, that's too much
so
candy?
We've actually seen
some of the merchandise already, and that is when it fully clicked. I was like, wait, okay, so this is me, and I'm doing this, and I did this! And I was, like, I was so confused. I was like, oh, wait, I did do this! This wasn't a dream, and it all started to click then, and it was so, I really couldn't believe it. And especially seeing the Lego, because I've grown up with Legos too. I love Lego.
Oh,
yeah.
And the minifigures were my favorite part of Legos too. So seeing my own minifigure
was
so
crazy.
Surreal.
I have been a Lego like stan my entire life. And just seeing it like for the first time was just mind-blowing.
I cried when I saw it.
Yeah?
I was just so shocked. Like it like became real.
Yeah. Definitely. Well, that is the time that I have with you all today. Thank you so much for chatting, and congrats on such an awesome show.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Next up, BJ had a chance to talk to Jude Law. This must have been pretty freaking cool. BJ, any setup for this one?
Okay. Yes. Okay. Little setup for this one as well. So Jude Law was my first interview of the day during this junket. And typically when you go to these junkets, you like walk into a room, the talent is sitting down. They just sort of like wave at you. Jude Law not only got up and like met me at the door, but then like was shaking my hand and was like having a conversation with me about like, oh, I hope you get the kids before they feed them cookies. And they're super like you know, overactive with sugar, but like was really, like really made that room welcoming. He wanted to talk to people about this project. And I was like, that's amazing. That does not happen very often. So Jude Law won a lot of points with me that day.
Very, very cool. Okay. Here is BJ's chat with Jude Law.
So the first question that I have for you is that you are working with children, like a big crew of children, and you've been performing for pretty much your entire life. So what is it that you think that you were able to learn from working with the children? Because I'm sure they're going to be asked all day, what did you learn
what
from
did you
Jude
learn
Law?
From Jude?
Yeah, what did you learn? Yeah. What did you learn for them?
Not much, kids. No. What did I learn from them? It's a lovely question. First of all, I was so impressed very, very quickly at how adept they were. And they arrived, you know, sometimes you work with kids and they've clearly been cast just because they're like the part. And then it's complicated because then you're really trying to just capture them doing what they do on camera. These were actors. Mm-hmm. These kids, they knew what to do. They were prepared. They really lent into the emotions and wanted to get it right. And I mean, they were professional actors. They were also kids. Mm-hmm. So there was this sense of play, and I think that's the key. They were a reminder that it is a playful environment. Even when you're doing drama, you know, mm-hmm. you're there, it's a magical environment. You're creating something. You're suspending belief. Obviously, in an environment like this, it's easier to do that because you've got creatures and spaceships and blasters and what have you. But even in a more you know, modest and humble kind of environment, you're still creating drama. So I think their sense of play and wonder was really infectious and a good reminder of just what and how you can approach the work.
I love hearing that so much because especially in something like Star Wars, which is so lore heavy.
Yes.
And there's probably going to be, you know, there always are people who will watch this and go, well, that wasn't correct for this
yes.
thing from whatever, whatever.
That's right.
That I think sometimes people get hung up on that and they forget that it is still fun. It is still a
That's
playful
right.
environment to be in. So I would love if you could share any of your preparation for entering such like a lore heavy world that is so beloved by so many people, which obviously you've done before with other franchises, but Star Wars is kind of its own beast. Like,
yes.
There really is nothing like it. So how do you prepare to enter this galaxy far, far away?
I had a lot of faith when it was pitched to me in John and Chris. They had done such hard work, and I love the concept of seeing it all through these young protagonists. Mm-hmm. And they also obviously knew the galaxy very, very well, or the canon. And, you know, we had the godfathers of Favreau and Filoni looking out for us, who were there to sort of, you know, fill any holes or gaps that may appear. I felt confident that I knew it pretty well. To me, it was more than anything, it was about getting the tone of the performance right. I'm someone who always enjoyed the kind of cynical humor of the films and contrasting that with the sort of jeopardy and the drama. I feel like that's the sweet spot of Star Wars for me and my memory of watching the first three, certainly as a kid. And so to me, it was more a case of really trying to weave all of that into the performance, into Jod. It wasn't a case of trying to make sure it wasn't my job really to make sure the details were correct. Mm-hmm. But then again, when we were discussing the past and his childhood, Jod's childhood, it was, you know, I checked all of that in with John and Chris, and I think in the end we used some of it in later episodes when we find out where he's from.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
If you find out where he's from.
Ooh.
Did I just give something away? No, I didn't.
No. So I think I have time for one last question. So the one that I have is that this is ultimately a coming of age story for these kids.
Yes.
And a big part of coming of age is the first time that you recognize that the world is one bigger than your own backyard. Mm. And that also it's a lot more complicated and it can be very, very scary at times. Mm. And I think your character is sort of representing something where, you know, there's this person that's looking out for them, but at the same time, what are the intentions, what are the motivations behind that? That's a complicated role to play. So what are you hoping that young viewers who watch this show take away from it?
Well, you just put it beautifully. I hope they take away, really jumping off what you've already said, this sense that the world can be beautiful and awe-inspiring and dangerous. And, you know, adults can appear like adults, but in many ways they're just big kids. You know, they're figuring it out too. Mm-hmm. Or some are. Most are. And so be careful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like that you said it is still big kids. We are still figuring it out. Because I think that's the thing is we have this genre of coming of age. We never really stop coming of age. We just come to a different age.
That's
and
right.
All of it.
And continue learning. And that's I think, the key. Keep learning. Keep asking yourself, you know, what can I learn from that? Mm-hmm. How can I do better? How can I be kinder? Or, you know, how can I be more aware?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's the time that I have with you today.
Thank you
so much for chatting with me.
That's
was wonderful.
Pleasure.
And congratulations on, I mean, feels like a great show. I've only seen three, but a great show.
I hope you
far.
Continue to enjoy it.
I will. Thank you so much.
And get over there before the sugar hits.
Absolutely. Nice meeting you.
And then finally, you had a chance to talk to John Watts and Chris Ford. I can't believe this is the first time we've mentioned John Watts' name. And I guess in the lead up to the show, we've mentioned his name a lot. But he is the director of the first episode. I think David Lowery directed the second episode. There's a whole bunch of great people working behind the scenes on this. And John Watts and Chris Ford, I believe, worked together previously on the live action Spider-Man movies. And now they are the creators and I think the co-showrunners, if I have my information correct, of Skeleton Crew here. So any final setup for this one, BJ, or should we just jump right into it?
The only setup that I have on here is that most people do know them from, you know, Skeleton Crew, obviously, and also their work with Spider-Man. But they also made the movie Cop Car, which is another kids getting into hijinks movie. So if people like what they see with Skeleton Crew and if they like their work with Spider-Man, I highly recommend people check out Cop Car, which is about kids stealing a cop car. Like, it's,
yeah.
Like, this is just such their brand that this is a perfect fit for them.
That's cool. I forgot that Chris Ford was involved in Cop Car. That's excellent. Okay, well, here is that final interview.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Hi, great.
Good. Wonderful to talk to you. So my first question for you is that between this and Spider-Man and Cop Car, you both seem obsessed with, like, kids getting into hijinks.
Yes.
What's that about? Tell me.
I don't know.
We don't
dramatic
know.
Childhood we're experience.
We're trying to work it out through all these scripts.
Through the medium of film.
Yeah.
I was going to say, so is this a reflection of your own histories of being kids getting into hijinks, or is this a little bit of wish fulfillment because you were a little bit of goody-goodies? What's going on there?
No, I think it's what I always wanted to happen as a kid. Mm-hmm. Like, I grew up in the middle of nowhere, and for fun, you just go walk in a field in a straight line, and you would just hope that you would, like, get abducted by aliens or, like, find a buried pirate treasure or something like that. And then that never happened. Mm-hmm. We never even found a cop car as much as we hoped that we would. So yeah, all of these films, I think, like, we're just trying to make that dream come true.
I like that. I definitely was a kid getting into hijinks, but getting into hijinks was walking on bike paths without a bike.
What a rebel.
I know. Who would have thought? So on sort of that note, there is now this very large world of different types of Star Wars stories. And I love that I get to live in a world where I can watch something very, like, mature and political like Andor, but then also something like very sweet and very fun and a very nice sense of, you know, acceptable danger, like in Skeleton Crew. And so I am curious, what are your favorite types of Star Wars stories?
Ooh, I mean, definitely big fans of Andor. And what was cool is that was coming out while we were shooting this. Mm-hmm. So, and we hadn't gotten any advanced versions of anything, so we were just like everyone else, just like on the set of this, talking about how cool, can you believe what's going on in Andor?
Yeah, I like anything in Star Wars that explores like an area of the world that you wouldn't think would be necessarily interesting.
Yeah.
Like when you get into like the bureaucracy, like I love like the Senate.
Yeah. Yeah. And like finding that in that little corner, there's an amazing story.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like those too. I think as fun, as exciting as it is when it's like, oh, we have lightsaber fights and there's big adventures and we're in space, it's also very fun to look at how the world actually operates, because
yes,
we need those stories to know how this all operates.
Yeah. I like, and it speaks to the potential of that, of the world, like how complex it is. Like you can just keep getting deeper and deeper into it.
Yeah.
yeah. in a way that's really fascinating.
Definitely. So something that I'm also always interested in whenever somebody is writing a coming-of-age story and they are writing characters that did not have a similar coming-of-age experience that they did, especially if it's across gender lines. So what did you want to capture with this crew of kids in each of their individual personalities? Where did those inspirations come from?
There's a dynamic that exists between the two boys and the two girls that is definitely something that I pulled from my life, like me and my friend, and then my older sister, and then her friend, who are they were brother and sister as well. The friends, like they were always just sort of terrorizing us. They were so much smarter than us, and they were always like taking advantage of the dumb boys. We tried to bring a little bit of that spirit into the show.
Yeah, I think that what's interesting is KB and Fern are also supposed to be a year older. Mm-hmm. It's kind of subtle in the Star Wars grades. It's like not as obvious. But I just think it was interesting because you could see on this planet, you know, you're supposed to take a test, get a job, and just kind of become part of this kind of machine. And there's something that's always been in Star Wars from the start, whether it's totally nefarious like the Empire or just kind of about, you know, life kind of pins you down and assigns you something that you're supposed to be doing as opposed to going off on an adventure. And it was interesting to be able to give that to Fern and KB, that they were 1 year closer to becoming boring grown-ups. Mm-hmm. And how are they going
to
break out of that?
Yeah, how do you find your own way to be a rebel?
Yeah.
Definitely. And I mean, coming-of-age stories, a common theme that usually happens is when you're this age and you start to learn that, one, the world is bigger than you thought it was, and also adults aren't perfect. They make mistakes. Some adults are actually like very dangerous.
Yeah.
And that can be a really hard truth to swallow. And there's a very fine line to walk when telling these stories that I think you both did very well and have done in previous projects. How do you know when you found that sweet spot of this is a story that is going to be something that younger viewers can watch and it's not going to traumatize them forever, but you're also not talking down to them?
Yeah. You always just think about it through the perspective of a 10-year-old. You know, I remember what it was like being 10. I wanted to be taken seriously. I wanted people to, you know, listen to me. But I also, you know, was 10. So I think you just sort of try to balance those two things, and hopefully somewhere in the middle of that, it starts to feel true.
Beautiful. How about you? Do you have anything to add?
Well, I just think, I mean, thematically, it's like Wim is naive and he kind of makes a mistake. Mm-hmm. And so you could kind of look on his 10-year-old dreamer self as that being a flaw. But at the same time, you have Jude's character, who's really worldly and maybe cynical and has survived in a dangerous galaxy for so long. But maybe there's something that he has to learn from these kids as well. And that kind of youthful glimmer of wanting something more is actually really meaningful in the end of the story.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you all have felt this the way that I have. I work a lot in like coming of age spaces. I'm very fascinated by this subgenre. And it seems like a lot of the output that we have for this sort of age of, you know, the tween into early teens, they haven't had much stuff for them. It seems like it's like you have Bluey and then you have slasher films, nothing in between anymore.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of doing a vital service for a lot of viewers. But on that note, I interview a lot of people, and people talk about, you know, the movies that made them want to make movies, want to write movies. Star Wars is without a doubt, it's like Star Wars and Jaws, like those are the two that people cite the most. But Skeleton Crew is likely going to be an introduction to this world for an entire generation of people. Have you processed yet that your project is going to foster that love of this world that is going to make a lot of other people want to make movies?
Wow.
Yeah, I think when Star Wars really works, no matter how old you are, it kind of makes you feel like you're 10. Mm-hmm. So by telling the story through the eyes of like four 10-year-olds, like we're hoping to sort of capture that same feeling of like what Star Wars felt like to us when we saw it the first time.
Yeah, and I mean, and to what you're saying, I think it's really weird being on this side of the Star Wars thing. I was a fan for so long. And as much as we like love our characters and we've crafted this whole story, put so much work into it, I still don't really feel like it's ours. It's kind of for the fans and for everyone who appreciates Star Wars. And so to me, it feels totally natural that new generation or other people will have their own opinions and take things from what we've done and do something else with it. Like, I'm so much more interested in being part of that continuing use of Star Wars as opposed to us saying, like, this is our story, the end.
Yeah.
It's more just like, I want to add into the communal thing. I mean,
it's nice to add a little bit of a postscript to the giant myth.
Yeah, and that's kind of, so much about filmmaking is so collaborative. So it's not like, I think it's this. It's like everyone comes together and works on it together.
Absolutely. I have time for one last question for you. What sort of conversations are you hoping people are going to have after they've finished the series and they're talking about this and how it fits into the greater world? What do you hope those conversations look like?
I'm really excited to see what people think the reverberations are through the rest of the galaxy for the things that happened in our show.
Yeah, and I'd be interested to see what kind of discussion there is around how Jod and the kids are maybe more similar than you might think, even through the twists and the climax or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, that there's a discussion there about what's really going on still.
Awesome. Well, thank you both so much for chatting with me today, and congratulations on what so far is one of my favorite Star Wars shows that I've seen recently. So this is great.
All right, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about Star Wars Skeleton Crew at slashfilm.com. Slashfilm Daily is published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Real quick before we go, Brian, where can people find your work online?
Well, obviously, I'm writing a lot about Skeleton Crew on Slash Film, so they can find my coverage of it right there on Slash Film. If you want to listen to me talk about Star Wars weekly, I do the Full of Sith podcast, so you can do that at fullofsith.com. And if you want to catch up on all my other writing, you can do so at swankmotron.com. And that's my handle on social media, so you can find me at swankmotron across social media, mainly Blue Sky lately.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
This time of year, a good hoodie is absolutely essential, and the American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last a lifetime. With timeless style, heavyweight fleece, and durable details, you can depend on it for years to come. Snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life. The American Giant Classic Full Zip, and save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code CLASSIC24 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code CLASSIC24.
231. That's the average number of apps used by many companies. This leads to a lot of context switching that can distract employees and costs your company. Luckily, Grammarly can help. Grammarly's AI works in over 500,000 apps and websites, making it easy for your team to crank out clear, on-brand emails, documents, messages, and more. In just one click, they can go from blank page to first draft, all without leaving the page they're on. Grammarly has 15 years of experience building effective, secure AI that can be implemented in days with minimal IT overhead. It goes beyond basic grammar to help tailor writing to specific audiences, whether that means adding an executive summary, fine-tuning tone, or cutting out jargon. Join 70,000 teams who save an average of $5,000 per employee per year using Grammarly. Go to Grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise Ready AI.